From the Land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 10th day of June 2022, USDA Report Day. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. We'll hear an update of the weather forecast, too, that from Eric Snodgrass at Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. And along the way today, Extension Field Crops and entomologist Nick Sider will update us on some of the pests, insect pests, that farmers and crop scouts should be on the lookout for in their fields this week. And it all happens on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
We'll begin today with USDA numbers released at 11 a.m. Central Time today. The old crop corn changed just a little bit. The carryout, now at 1.485 billion bushels, is 45 million bushels bigger than it was last month. For soybeans, the carryout at 205 million bushels is 30 million bushels smaller. We'll take up more on the reasons why in just a bit, but let's go through the summary of these numbers. Again, corn carryout at 1.485 billion bushels, and this year's expected yield is 177 bushels to the acre. That's unchanged for a total production of unchanged number at 14.46 billion bushels. Puts the carryout for next year at 1.4 billion bushels with a season's average cash price for corn at $6.75. Soybean carry-in again, 205 million bushels. And the yield stays the same at 51.5, with production of 4.64 billion bushels of soybeans this season, to put a carryout of 280 million bushels, down 30 million from last month for the soybeans, and a $14.70 season's average cash price. July corn today at $7.73 and a quarter, finished a quarter cent higher. December at $7.20 and a half, up 3 3/4. July beans at $17.45 and a half, 23 and a half cents lower. In November, down 14 cents, settled at $15.68 and a quarter. The bean meal at $4.29.10, up $1.60. The bean oil on its settlement, $80.81, $1.82 lower. Soft red winter wheat down a half at $10.70 and 3/4 for the July, and the hard red July at $11.62 and a half, up 8 3/4 of a cent. Live cattle futures at $136.20, down $1 for 100 pounds. Feeders at $174.47 and a half, $1.55 lower, and lean hogs at $103.75, up 65 cents. Crude oil, $121 near $120 and a half, down $1.03 a barrel. Mike Zuzulo, GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas, now joins us to take a look at what's happened in the marketplace on this USDA report day. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being with us. Let's start with what happened right as the USDA report came out. Were there any jumps in the marketplace? How did it receive the news, which was mostly pretty blasé, I think?
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think probably the biggest price action was maybe in the soybeans and then also in the wheat, because we did see quite a bit of differences between the world numbers and the U.S. numbers in both of those areas, in both of those commodities, Todd. So you could kind of feel the trade go through the U.S. numbers and then the world numbers, and that seemed to give us some extra volatility.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. USDA in the domestic numbers up the yield by 0.3 of a bushel. What did they do globally on the wheat side?
I think the big thing they did globally was raise the Russian exports by 1 million tons, but cut the Indian exports by 2 million tons, so that when it was all said and done, world wheat ending stocks to use ratios really didn't move much. They went from 33.9% to 34%. And I think this is where the world numbers actually supported the trade, because they ended up being on the lower end of trade estimates from the news wires. And that was a welcome change. And it wasn't, it was nice to see the reaction in prices, because the pre-report price action was kind of typical of what you and I talk about before a WASDE report, where the trade tends to buy soybeans and they tend to sell wheat. And it's usually because they get a bigger demand number in soybeans and tend to lose demand in the wheat, especially world demand. But we didn't see that as much today. And I think that really helped us, along with the fact that in the domestic numbers, while we did see that yield increase, as you're talking about, we saw the hard red wheat production number go down again. And I think that really helped us, helped with the spread trade, because as we went into the close, the hard red wheat was back up double digits heading towards its highs.
One resource people can go check out, and I haven't watched all of this, but know enough of it from watching the YouTube version of the Post Report YouTube discussion that about the WASDE, that they really at USDA were thinking a lot about the heat, particularly that came in March in India and how that impacted the crop. You can search June USDA WASDE on YouTube and you'll find that. You mentioned soybeans. How, if at all, did the world numbers change in it?
Yeah, this is where I think the world numbers really took out the supportive feature of the U.S. numbers, because we did see old crop soybean demand go up 30 million bushels in exports. That ended up taking us down to a 205 carryover for old crop. And now we started off with a 205 beginning stocks number for this marketing year. So we'd lost 30 million bushels, which translated into a 280 carryover domestically. That would have been, I think, very supportive, because that's about a 6.1% stocks to use ratio, Todd. But we saw Brazil go up 1.4 million in production for soybeans, and Argentina go up a million. So we had a 2.4 million metric ton increase, and in both of those countries went up. I think that truly surprised the trade, especially given that some of those low numbers, you know, from 2-3 months ago in Brazil were 122, 123. And I think the trade was still hanging on to some of those numbers. And so taking the ending stocks globally up above 100 million metric tons, I think says a lot psychologically, especially when we were dancing on within a dime of taking out the 2008 highs in lead month soybeans. So I think it made sense the soybeans needed to cool off, given the report, given the correction in the crude oil market, and especially given the fact that the canola and the palm oil markets really fell flat on their face late in the week as Indonesia opened up their exports again. So I think the beans of all three commodities really need the hot, dry weather next week to hold themselves together and maybe not give a potential technical sell signal.
Well, let's talk about the end of the trade today on this Friday, or the end of the week trade, because beans were off. That simply came because of the USDA report?
I don't think it was all because USDA. As I said, the canola market was down pretty hard. And in fact, bean oil was going to end up down about 2.5% in the deferred contract December contract. And July was going to be down about 1.3% before settlements. So I think this is where you had several factors coming into play. As I said, I really think the trade, and they were right, you got that increase in exports by 30 million bushels in the old crop. And so they were right to buy into the beans on a stronger demand mindset pre-WASDE, but I think they deserved and made sense for them to take some of that premium out after the numbers came out because of that big global supply. I just can't get over the idea that USDA raised both Brazil and Argentina in the same month, as you know they're pretty much getting into, you know, ending up with pretty much at the end of harvest, so to speak. So it's late in the year for them to see an increase when we are on a declining mindset.
USDA changed both the old crop and new crop corn supply and demand tables, upping ending stocks in both. Where did they make the change and how did it translate through?
Yeah, the big change, I think, in the corn, really, in domestically, we're talking about, really came from the old crop again. They did take food, seed, and industrial up 5 million bushels, but they cut exports 50 million bushels. So you could say at this stage, in old crop corn, we're playing the defensive. We are rationing demand. And so that took us down in terms of the demand side of the equation, and total usage slipped by 45 million bushels. And so we ended up seeing a 45 million bushel increase in beginning stocks. That translated directly into an increase up to about 1.4 billion bushels. So this is where we're at a 9.6 stocks to use ratio domestically. Last year, we finished up at a 10%. We really need to go towards that 2021 stocks to use ratio of about 8.3%. So we need to keep the demand intact here and really slip below a 1.3 billion bushel carryover to kind of keep the bull running if we lose the wheat bull.
Can we do that with $5 gasoline across the United States, which I would somehow find incredible if consumers didn't start to back away from miles?
Exactly. You bring up a huge point, and this is where I had another fellow ask me today on the bean oil, well, isn't that jet fuel and biofuel demand going to stay intact? And no, it doesn't have to. And look at the airlines cutting their flights back, in some cases by 10%, and a lot of airlines are losing their regional airports and their flights there. That's a lot of excess jet fuel usage. And you're right, the gasoline demand net could go down, even though the ethanol margins are so good compared to unleaded minus ethanol that E15 should be red hot out there in the country where you can get it. I think you bring up a huge point, Todd, whether you're talking about energies or grains, and in light of the consumer price index, and it's supercharging the dollar trade today, the dollar up almost 1% on the day, and the stock market down substantially. This is not demand-led inflation. I really believe it's cost push, it's supply, and it's weather, and I think we've got to keep that in the forefronts of our minds, especially when China shows their producer prices dropping to the lowest level since March of 2021. If you want to talk about peak inflation, you can talk about China. I don't think you talk about here yet because of the supply and the weather issues.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Todd. Have a great weekend, sir.
You too. That's Mike Zuzulo. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Nick Sider is an Extension field crops entomologist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois and has dropped by for an update of insect pest problems across the state. What have you been hearing about, Nick?
I really haven't received a lot of reports of early season insect damage so far. That's probably a reflection of a couple of things. One, we've had, for the most part, at least in central Illinois, relatively good early season growing conditions. The other thing we've had is a lot of the corn and soybean were planted over a relatively short window of time. With bean leaf beetles, for example, where we see heavy feeding from those is where you get some fields planted very early that kind of concentrates that population. We've probably got a decent bean leaf beetle population out there, but it's been pretty spread out among all these soybean fields that are really coming up at about the same time here in Illinois. Have gotten a few reports of cutworm damage, and this was particularly kind of in southeast central Illinois, where we also had some reports of not so great control of winter annuals, and that's typically where we see problems with that insect, is where we have some winter annuals out there that draw them in to lay their eggs, and then those larvae move off of that into corn.
And what should farmers and field scouts be on the lookout for coming up?
So in central Illinois and getting up into northern Illinois, our rootworm egg hatch has started. We're right about at 50% rootworm hatch, a little bit past that here in Champaign, Illinois. And we're getting pretty close to that in northern Illinois as well. So over the next couple of weeks, as those larvae start to develop, if you have a rootworm problem, you'll be able to see some of those signs of damage. And especially if you start to see drought stress symptoms in a field that really shouldn't be under drought stress, that's a pretty good indication that you ought to dig that plant up and dig those plants up and take a look at the roots themselves. This is also a good time to be looking out for the first signs of corn borer, especially if you have fields where you have non-GMO, you've had long-term non-GMO in the same area, or if it's, you know, specialty corn, something that doesn't have that corn borer protection in it. Haven't heard any reports whatsoever of resistance to the above-ground toxins with corn borer just yet. And so for many years, our corn borer problems have been fairly minimal. But this would be the time that that first generation should be becoming active.
That's Nick Sider. He's a field crops entomologist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Hey, thank you so much for taking your time and spending it with us here at Illinois Public Media each and every day during the closing market report and weekly on Commodity Week. It means a great deal to me. I hope that these programs are useful to you. You can always contact me if you want. My name is Todd Gleason. The address is tgleason@illinois.edu for email or 217-333-9697. They're on the website at willag.org. Thank you. On this Friday, let's check the weather forecast now with Eric Snodgrass. He's with Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agrible. Good Friday to you, Eric. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again.
Let's start with what's happened over the last 7 days across the Corn Belt and where folks have gotten rainfall and what kind of conditions they're in.
Yeah, so I took a little tour this week. I had a talk to give out near Omaha and another one in Kansas City. So I drove 74 to 80, then south on 29, and then back across 36. So I took this little loop of Illinois, Iowa, parts of Nebraska, parts of Kansas, and Missouri. So that's the idea. The crop looked amazing. Okay, it was all about the same height, which is short, but it looked fantastic. While I was out there, the Central Plains had multiple days of severe weather. So there were some places that got a bunch of hail, big hail, hit the crop hard, severe straight line winds, and some of those storms put down a lot of very heavy rainfall. This morning, they're going out of Texas and Oklahoma down toward Arkansas. So it's all south of us now. So the issue with that particular setup is that there are places that got some rain recently ahead of the heat that's coming up. Now, there are also pockets, places in Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, two important, very important places that did not get that rain. And as a result of that, we're very concerned that we're going to go into this next time period of above average temperatures without the moisture in place to endure these high evaporation rates. So that's the setup. It looks good, but we have risk in the near term that we're going to have to watch carefully.
So it's kind of about the haves and the have-nots?
Yeah, it's the way it feels right now. And so you're going to have some folks that are like, all right, I can take a few days or even a week or so of some heat and dry conditions because of the moisture profile. And you have other folks that are looking at it regionally saying, I mean, from Indiana to eastern Illinois, parts of it getting down into southern Illinois, that's one spot nearby where there's folks in there that are very concerned about trying to endure some heat that's coming up.
Well, tell me about the two-week outlook.
Yeah, so it's all about jet stream behavior. And I swear, you and I, for the last, what, 3, 4, 5 weeks, have been talking about this extended, unbroken, you know, jet stream pattern that's gone from Egypt all the way through the Pacific and ending up in Ireland. All right, that's breaking down. It'll be broken down fully by next Saturday. But even before next Saturday, we've got heat coming in on like Tuesday and Wednesday. Todd, I'm not joking. We may knock on the door of 100 degrees Fahrenheit on Tuesday this upcoming week. It might move around, but it's going to be hot. Now, it's what's after that. That next weekend, getting into the following week, where that big, long, extended jet's now broken up into several pieces, and we call it the triple ridge pattern. So what we got is a ridge north of Hawaii, a ridge that sits between Texas and Montana, and then a ridge that sits just off the East Coast near Bermuda. And if that gets stuck and it stays there, we start to worry about the longer-term forecast because that one brings in drier conditions and hotter conditions. And the only way you get rain out of it is if you're lucky enough to be under where those pop-up storms occur.
Yeah, talking about the longer-range forecast, do you have anything that gives me between the two and, I don't know, say 6 weeks?
I do. The latest European, what we call the European weeklies, they run a 45-day forecast. It's not day by day, but what you're getting is the bigger picture of what the next 45 days holds. And the thing is that the models want to take what we've seen and just keep it going. In other words, put that ridge in place and keep redeveloping it. So you can't find a long-range forecast right now that doesn't show up with, well, essentially hotter and drier conditions from the Central Plains, Midwest, Corn Belt. I'll tell you what I'll be watching for. Yeah, we're going to bring in periods of heat and drier conditions, and that will develop regional drought. What I don't want to see, and this is key, I don't want to see western Tennessee and Kentucky, southern Illinois, Arkansas, Oklahoma. I don't want to see that area get very dry. Because if drought develops there, think about it. If the moisture is going to come from the Gulf of Mexico later this summer, and it has to go over the top of very hot and dry conditions that are to our south, it never makes it here. So the moisture doesn't get here and we kind of spiral toward drought. Now that's just a what if, but some of the models are starting to sniff that out and just got me concerned until I see otherwise. That's the way it goes.
Well, that makes me think about the hurricane season, which is predicted to be a really tough one, meaning that the number of hurricanes should be high, but usually that would be rainfall that comes into those areas. And so you're thinking, hey, wait a second, maybe not. And things get really difficult at that point then.
You're right. I mean, if you bring a big tropical system up at some point in July, which remember, July is the very beginning of the hurricane season. So we're talking about an early season hurricane that could help with that. Then yeah, you could soak that area and then recycle that moisture and we'd have a lot more happy, or I should say less anxious people in the midsection of the United States. But hurricane season, remember, really gets going in August and it peaks mid-September. So those are often late season events that we end up talking about delivering moisture at those times. So it's an issue of timing. And the problem has been that the crop went in late. It's going to mature, or it's going to reach, you know, those reproductive stages probably middle of July. And that's just a time period I'm worried about because some of the long range models are reaching out there, seeing some risk for drought.
Speaking of those, I think there are some new long-range models out.
We did. We got two of them of the four I like to look at. So I'm still waiting on the Climate Prediction Center. That's one of the big ones. But the European model and what's called the NMME, it's a suite of seven different models that are run here in North America. They came through and they didn't change. They said, you know, the risk of above average temperatures in the central United States and the risk of drought redevelopment is still there. So the fact that they didn't trend away from that is important information, but that's all we use them for. We use them for guidance. We use them for trend. We use them to just assess the bigger picture, not to pinpoint any any region or any number. So they didn't back away from it, which means I can't back away from worrying about it.
Weather in the Midwest is a driver in the marketplace. Everybody's worried about that. However, there are other places in the Northern Hemisphere that we should keep track of. Of course, we're watching Ukraine, Russia, the war, but there's Ukraine, Russia, the weather as well.
Yeah.
What are conditions like there?
Well, they were dry in Ukraine, all the way from Ukraine to France back in parts of May. And then they've had rain as of late. So it kind of broke away from that risk of early drought development. But the La Nina is still there. It's weakening. That's totally expected for summer. La Ninas almost always wane at some point in late spring into summer. But the impact it may have had on the atmosphere is still shown up in the longer range models. So Southern Europe, from like the Iberian Peninsula all the way across like Italy, over toward Ukraine, but as far south as, you know, Greece, that whole region continues to show up with risk of being hotter and drier. So what did get planted, we may have to still worry about the atmosphere pulling back yields on what should already be some lower production numbers. And remember, they shifted a lot of their crop types this year. So it's a wild card what's coming out of Europe right now.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it. We'll talk with you again next week.
Yeah, sounds good.
That's Eric Snodgrass. He's with Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agable. Join us on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for this Friday, the 10th day of June. Don't forget Commodity Week. Our weekly program is up online now at willag.org, and many of these radio stations will carry it over the weekend. You can always hear it, willag.org. The theme music for the Closing Market Report is produced by Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason, written by him as well. You have a great weekend. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.